History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. During World War II, nearly 1 billion letters were sent to the front, but none struck more fear into the heart of the average soldier than one that began with the following. Dear John, I don't know quite how to begin, but I just want to say that Joe Doakes came to town on furlough the other night, and he looked very handsome in his uniform, so when he asked me for a date... Such is an example of the Dear John letter that the World War II GIs received from sweethearts or wives at home who had decided to politely but unceremoniously end their relationship. Though the phrase Dear John was coined during World War II, and the breakup letters have found their way into every American war since then, the origins of the term have been shrouded in obscurity. Today's guest is Susan Carruthers, author of the book Dear John, Love and Loyalty in Wartime America. We look at the history of the Dear John letter and explore wartime relationships and breakdowns from multiple perspectives, civilian and military, male and female, historical and contemporary. Carruthers looked at a diverse range of research using personal letters, declassified documents, press reports, psychiatric literature, movies, and popular music. We look into how the armed forces and civilian society have attempted to weaponize romantic love in pursuit of martial ends. So the negative effects of these letters and breakups are obvious, but there are also unintended positive effects, such as leading to wartime camaraderie. Wartime relationships are a staple of fiction, think Casablanca and countless other movies, but they can also be incredibly rocky. So what do these relationships look like during wartime? What happens when the war ends? And what can that tell us about society and history? This is an important feature to understand of really every war that's ever been fought, and something I think we need to understand if we want to understand the experience of war in its totality. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Susan Carruthers. Susan, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Scott. I'm really looking forward to having a chat.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here, but I suppose one good place to begin is laying the groundwork of how relationships change, at least in the United States, after World War II begins. I think there's a broad understanding that after the Pearl Harbor attack, the U.S. almost overnight goes from its largely isolationist, Depression-era approach to international affairs into full-scale war mobilization. Industries are retooling. Young men are filling recruiting stations. Japan goes from a nation that sometimes bumps up against the United States' Pacific ambitions into its sworn enemy. I'm wondering if there's a similar kind of overnight change that happens with relationships. Are wedding chapels filling up with young men readying for war and marrying their sweethearts? Are there lots of shotgun weddings due to pregnancies? What happens after World War II begins?
Well, I think you have definitely anticipated where things go in marital terms. There was a very pronounced uptick in the rush to the altar or its civic functional equivalent in the United States within weeks, if not days, of the Pearl Harbor attack and the United States officially entering into World War II. So, of course, it was pretty clear the way in which things were heading and quite a lot of young men had already been drafted before the attack on Pearl Harbor. But being formally in a state of war definitely galvanized many young couples. And for all sorts of reasons, they were eager to solemnize their vows. They wanted to make sure that if the young man was deployed overseas, he would have what hopefully would turn into a secure emotional anchorage for the duration of his deployment. Some couples were marrying because they wanted to have sort of protective covering of marriage to make sex acceptable at a time when sex outside of marriage, before marriage, was definitely not acceptable in most quarters. And this was something that really troubled a lot of American authorities. The military wasn't keen, certainly on junior enlisted men marrying, and in fact forbade the lowest ranks of enlistees from marrying without their commanding officer's consent. But all sorts of Americans weighed in on this increasingly vexed question of war marriage, and sometimes dubbed war hysteria marriage, fearing that young Americans were rushing to tie the knot for all the wrong reasons as they saw them. So you're quite right that marriage becomes a site of very intense national conversation, young couples are rushing to marry. In fact, 1942 represented the year in which more American couples got married than at any point in prior US history. And alongside that is all of this anxious national discourse about whether couples should be married.
How does this discourse play out? Do most people fear that they're entering a permanent relationship or so-called permanent relationship that has rocky foundations from the beginning? Are other people thinking that this is solid, this will give them something that will comfort them, and when they're facing down the enemy, they have long nights away from their home in a foreign country, it reminds them what they're fighting for? What does this discourse look like?
Well, I think your question is inviting me perhaps to start off by thinking about how young Americans themselves made sense of the sort of shifting sands of emotional intimacy at the start of this global war. And I think for a lot of couples, and in some cases, perhaps the impetus came more from one or other of parties to a partnership, there was a hope that it would provide them with emotional security, that knowing that you had someone who loved you would be comforting, reassuring when you were far away and perhaps in danger, perhaps even in facing mortal danger. It would give you something to fight for. It would give you someone and something to return to in the shape of a loving family to which to return. But then, of course, there are the other people who are sternly admonishing Americans who might be thinking about marrying to hold off. They were worried that the people, as I just said, were rushing into ill-conceived relationships, perhaps with a partner that was barely known to them. So there was this phenomenon of young men who had been sent off to training camps, getting a furlough, they got a weekend pass, and going and marrying a girl that they perhaps only just met, marrying someone that they maybe were only acquainted with through the medium of letter writing, which is, of course, one of the big topics that my book about Dear John Letters explores. And, of course, concerns about sex were rife in this discourse, that people were marrying because they wanted to have sex and they would do much better to maintain their chastity and abstinence, and that would be better both for them and for the moral character of the nation. And of course, those who are weighing in from a lofty vantage point of being an expert, so a lot of eminent sociologists and others were offering their views on this. The American Historical Association perhaps surprisingly produced a pamphlet aimed at enlisted men about whether they should marry or not. Probably wouldn't think about the AHA being in the business of offering marriage guidance counsel, but there it was. So, you know, they were concerned about the sort of moral and practical dimensions of this. And sometimes they were also thinking back to what had happened in the first great globe-spanning war, when there had been a similar moral panic about people marrying for the wrong reasons. And of course, what happened soon after the end of the Great War, as Doughboys returned from France, was that divorce rates did indeed spike. And so that was a large piece of this as well, that the kinds of war marriages that young Americans might be entering into would not be likely to stay the course, and that the nation should be buffered against the prospect of another alarming escalation of divorce rates when this wave of soldiers returned at the end of the war.
I've been to a number of historical academic conferences, and I can't think of anyone more poorly suited to offer long-term relationship advice than the AHA or any other sort of historical body. If you see people there, there are many things and many wonderful things, but experts on long-term relationships, I don't think are really that. So I'm glad that hasn't stuck with us, and I can't imagine their advice in that area was stellar. So let's come to the letters themselves. There's a lot of other themes I want to come back to with the nation and civic society trying to sort of weaponize romantic love in pursuit of national goals. Mm. But first, what led you to Dear John letters and what made you want to focus on them as the subject of your book?
Okay, well, a couple of different paths from earlier projects led me to this particular destination. So one project often begets another, but sometimes the way in which it begets another may be a little circuitous. So in this case, I had worked my most recent previous book, which is called The Good Occupation, American Soldiers and the Hazards of Peace, which came out in 2016, explores the experiences of being part of an occupying army. And there I was looking at Americans in the immediate aftermath of World War II. So wherever Americans occupied in the wake of that war, particularly, of course, Germany and Japan, but other places that are less well remembered, like Italy and Korea. I wanted to try to get a handle on the day-to-day texture of life, the outlook, the sensibilities of occupation troops, not least because for most of them, this was something that they desperately did not want to do. As you might imagine, most people, having been, in many cases, drafted into fighting a war, want nothing more than to get back home as soon as they possibly can. So to try to unpack all of that, I went off and dug up in many, many archives across the US, private papers, letters, unpublished memoirs. And I became really fascinated by reading hundreds of correspondences between servicemen and women and their loved ones back home. And there is a certain kind of voyeuristic thrill, I guess, in a sense, as a historian, that you get to read things that you weren't necessarily meant to be reading in some cases, that perhaps the offspring, the sort of sons, daughters of people who served in the military later bequeathed to an archive. But anyway, suffice to say that one of the things that became very clear to me, although this was not at all what I was in search of and writing about in that book, was just how hard it was to sustain an emotional connection, the tremendous pressures that spouses, that partners, fiancés faced in navigating their way through an extended deployment that in some cases was going to last years, which I think now is easy to forget, that Americans who went off overseas in World War II didn't necessarily know how long they would be away for. And of course, they did not necessarily know that they would ever come back. So a lot of tension, psychological stress in the mix. And one of the things that I was also really intrigued by, which helped in a more direct way lead me to this topic, was often how free partners felt in giving voice to all their anxieties about the relationship, its durability, their fearfulness about their partner's fidelity, doubts about whether they might be sleeping with someone else, what it meant if they found a new sexual partner or partners while they were overseas. And I was really quite surprised by that, not least because during the war, and for at least a short period thereafter, anyone in the military who was writing these letters was doing so knowing that their commanding officer or an officer was going to be reading it. So the fact that they would be so free with all of this messy, murky, difficult emotional stuff was a revelation to me. And I just got very curious about, well, how did this all work? Now, another strand of my research from way back deals with the media and war. That's something that I wrote about a lot in the earlier part of my career. And I became quite interested in, more recently, not just in the obvious public ways in which the media tell stories about war, but about how communications technologies, which are constantly evolving, as we all know very, very well, how these different modes of communication, channels of connectivity, helped or in some cases perhaps hindered separated partners in this endeavor of trying to keep intimacy alive during deployments. So if you've read the book, then you'll know that these issues about technology, how people stay in touch, or indeed how they end relationships, is one piece of the picture that I try to paint.
Now, as an aside, when it comes to the research process, I'm very curious that you had so much access to these, because if I were keeping up correspondence and my whole romantic life were imploding, I wouldn't necessarily want to keep those letters for posterity and file them in the Library of Congress with the hopes that a future researcher could display them to the world. Now, I'm very glad that did happen because we can have this conversation now. But were these kept by the military, their correspondence?
Well, I guess I have to correct you gently a little bit here, because one thing that I quickly discovered in my research process was that, of course, as you quite correctly imagined, Dear John letters were not the kinds of epistles from home that very many servicemen at all clung on to and kept, let alone then at some later date bequeathing to an archive. So the book is not based on my having unearthed and carefully parsed hundreds or thousands of Dear John letters. This is probably an important thing for your readers to be aware of. For obvious reasons, just as you surmised, most guys who are broken up with by letter quickly consign that piece of paper to oblivion. And the ways in which they do so are many. They're probably quite easily imagined. And those means of the modes of disposal, along with what the letters said, what motivated them, resides much more fully in the kinds of stories that servicemen and veterans tell. So this was one of the sort of first big epiphanies of my research process, that if I thought I was going to write a book about a particular female genre of letter writing, then I was rather mistaken, because mostly Dear John letters do not survive into the archive. I mean, I do talk about some in particular, which we know for sure that women wrote, but very often the examples that get circulated, including ones that historians write about in sort of studies of World War II letter writing or the Vietnam War, in some cases we don't actually know for sure that these aren't apocryphal urban legends as opposed to letters that really were written by actually existing women in precisely the form of words that history has bequeathed to us. So what I do in the book is to try to excavate everything that swirls around the Dear John letter, this most notorious of wartime communications. And I went digging in a lot of different places, but perhaps the single richest source is, as I just suggested, in servicemen's and veterans' oral histories. So I sort of get at the Dear John as something that has been constructed in large measure, but of course not entirely, by the sorts of stories that men have told about the women who wrote them Dear John letters, what they had to say in these notes, and the impact that they had. So a lot of the time when I was doing my research was spent in a number of different archives, but particularly in the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress, where I listened to hundreds of hours of testimony in all sorts of collections where I knew, thanks to the wonderful archivist, that there would be a Dear John story somewhere in a long oral history.
What sort of patterns did you notice among the women who sent these letters? In what sort of circumstances were they when they sent these letters? What were their rationale and any other patterns that you noticed in them?
Okay, well, I mean, it's quite hard to answer that precise question, bearing in mind that most of what we know about the letters we know from men, and men tend to concentrate right. much more on the impact on them or their bodies than they do on what might have motivated the women who sent them. Now, of course, in the book, I want to try to offer a more complicated picture. Not surprisingly, a lot of the sort of public narrative around the senders of Dear John letters tends to be very negative indeed, that these were women who were perhaps always prone to flightiness. Some of the stories tend to be quite misogynistic in character. Not always, of course. They might be stories about women who simply got bored. They didn't have the tenacity to wait. Someone else caught their eye. Sometimes they're stories that are also tinged with avarice, that they sort of ran off having depleted the service's bank balance and so on. But I want to try to remind readers of everything that made sustaining a relationship hard for both partners in a wartime couple. So the pressures on women might have been many, and I think it's also worth bearing in mind, particularly in World War II, which is where we started out, that there was this overwhelming pressure on women to write to servicemen, that this was held up as a patriotic obligation, in essence, that to keep up the morale of boys overseas, that women should be writing to servicemen, not necessarily men that they knew even, but, you know, preferably boys from their community, sending them endlessly cheery, uplifting notes, perhaps with little gifts and so on. And a lot of women did that. But of course, the two parties in these exchanges quite often may have had wildly divergent understandings of the nature of this relationship. So a girl may have thought, well, I'm writing because I keep seeing sort of posters from the Office of War Information telling me that I need to do my bit, and that the job of women isn't just to do munitions work or be a riveter like Rosie. It's also to wield the pen and to write these morale-boosting missives. So they were writing, in some cases, for those sorts of reasons, and women have written to servicemen in later American wars with the same mindset. But not surprisingly, some of the men who received these letters developed very different ideas about the women who've sent them and what this exchange of messages means. So they, you know, understandably, perhaps if they're lonely, they're overseas for the first time, their life is intermittently boring and terrifying, start to build elaborate fantasies around the women who are writing them letters. So they think they have a girlfriend, but the young woman doesn't necessarily think that she has a boyfriend or has entered into any kind of romantic commitment to the young man. So we can readily see, I think, in those sorts of cases, why a woman, if the young man started more insistently broaching ideas about dating or even marrying this woman he'd never met, that she might want to send a letter saying, we need to just be clear about this. Actually, you've misunderstood. So that's just one instance of, you know, why a woman might have chosen to end a relationship. But there are, of course, all sorts of pressures on partners that make it very hard. I mean, if letter writing is your only way of staying in touch, letter writing can soon turn into something that's pleasurable, to something that feels burdensome and obligation, that since you have nothing new to say, if you're being encouraged, as the US government did in World War II, to write at least once every day. Oh my goodness, what do you keep finding to say once, twice, or thrice daily in your loving V-mail? So there's a lot of pressure, and I'm happy to explore some of the other pressures as well.
Right. I mean, I think anyone who would only casually think about this topic would assume that it's glib and cold-hearted to break up with a man on the front lines when he could very well die the next day. And what does it really take from you to continue the relationship? But as you've presented here, this could very well be a couple that only had been in any sort of relationship, or maybe not even any serious relationship before the war, and then ran into it. And then as the months and the years go on, you may find on the other side in the United States that, well, I'm investing more and more into this relationship with a person that I really don't know that well. And he's been deployed for 1 year. Now it's 2 years. Now it's 3 years, which happened with, say, men in the Pacific Theater, where they were gone a very long time. But yeah, could you speak more to that, on what you were able to glean on the experiences of women from whether it's World War II or whether it's later wars?
Sure. So I think your point about the extended duration of tours, especially in the Pacific, is well made. I think it's also helpful just to bear in mind how very, very young in many American wars the average age of service personnel was. So we're talking quite often about couples who are teenagers. And if we think about the high rate of attrition amongst teenage relationships, when perhaps one or both parties go off to college or separated, it becomes even more understandable why a relationship that's under severe duress, separation, danger, distance, may not stay the course. I mean, something else that I would really like to inject into our discussion is also to challenge the received wisdom about the senders of Dear John letters being cowardly and cruel. In my research, those were the two adjectives that most frequently are applied to these women, that they are simply sending a Dear John because they're too timid, too spineless to actually stand in front of the man and say to his face, it is over. Now, I think that sort of stock narrative does a huge disservice to some women who ended relationships by letter or other means of communication with men who are deployed overseas. The advice that particularly female advice columnists have given over successive decades, including up into the 21st century, was always to hold off on sending a Dear John. You know, it's the most worst, injurious thing you could possibly do to a man who's deployed. Don't do it. Wait till he comes back. But it seems to me that that advice could, in some cases, be really quite dangerous. If we imagine a man coming back from active duty, he's, even in the best of circumstances, navigating what could often be quite a perilous passage back from the world of war to the realm of domestic home life. That's challenging. He may have incurred psychological, emotional injuries in the course of his wartime service. Of course, you know, now we have a whole vocabulary of PTSD. And the idea that in this perhaps quite psychologically vulnerable moment, a woman divulges the unwelcome news that actually for 2-3 years she's been sending him loving letters and it's all been a sham, doesn't seem to me to be advice that's in the best interests of either of those partners, potentially. And certainly there have been cases where women who broke the news belatedly that they'd been maintaining a performance of an affectionate relationship that was actually ended long since, have suffered from retaliatory violence, in some cases homicidal violence, from their male partner. So that, it seems to me, is also worth factoring into our picture, that we're dealing in some cases with extremely troubling trends in military relationships and in the often hazardous passage back to home life.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Right, it's easy to imagine that all of these relationships are ideal, that they've are engaged and about to be married, or maybe they are married and have a solid relationship. But as you mentioned, I mean, many of these people are teenagers, and how many emotionally mature teenagers do you know who could handle a relationship, you know, with a years-long separation? I personally don't know many. So there's a lot of complications here, which I'm glad that we're fleshing out. Well, I'd love to hear also the reaction from soldiers and Marines and others. As a first pass, I mean, the reaction is probably quite obvious, but was there anything that surprised you as you got further and further into their account?
Yes, there were many things that surprised me. And this is why being a historian is, as I see it, the best job in the world, that you're constantly finding things that you didn't expect that upend your understandings, that totally take you aback. So for me, perhaps one of the things that I wasn't expecting, as I was exploring more and more of the kinds of stories that men tell about Dear John Letters, was how much humor I would encounter, because we've been talking quite a bit about the sort of standard narratives around the kinds of women who send Dear John letters and how awful and unspeakable they are. And I think intuitively I would have expected that quite a lot of the stories around Dear John letters would be angry stories. They'd be stories of grievance, of sort of hurt feelings, of just how challenging the impossible situations that men are plunged into when they're abandoned at a moment of real sort of danger and difficulty. And yet what I discovered quite often was there's this sort of broad swathe of humor, jocularity that runs through quite a lot of the Dear John stories that I encountered, both at the Veterans History Project and in all sorts of other places where I went looking. And this was not what I expected. So some of the stories actually made me laugh out loud, which I'm not in the habit of. Like most historians, very, very careful of not causing a disturbance in the archives. But there was definitely one Dear John story that I was so taken aback by its unexpected reverse ending that it had me laughing out loud. But just generally, I mean, GIs, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, you know, they are very good at telling jokes and anecdotes and turning things that are quite grim into sources of humor. So there's a lot of sort of playful ritual starting in World War II, right around the time that the Dear John phrase comes into coinage, of men who are serving in India forming these brush-off clubs and playfully giving themselves little offices like weeper-in-chief, consoler-in-chief, and so on, and trying to redeem heartbreak through all of this kind of horseplay and fun that they had with the letters and with bonding over the experience of being rejected. And women in the Women's Army Corps also set up their own auxiliary branches of the Brush-Off Club. And I think that's something else I definitely want to draw your readers' attention to, is that one thing that often gets left out of the story, because there's just culturally so much more attention paid to the Dear John letter, is that in each of the wars that I look at, from World War II to the present, women have repeatedly tried to raise their voices and say, but wait a minute, we get dumped, we get abandoned, we get sexually betrayed, emotionally jettisoned by servicemen, our boyfriends. You know, women in the WACs, whether their boyfriends were also in uniform or whether they were civilian men, they too underwent the experience of emotional betrayal and abandonment in war. But so little bandwidth was available for the telling and sharing of those stories. And so I do try to pay attention to those female voices and offer some explanation as to why the Dear Jane trope was so belated and why it's never really caught on in the same way.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that as well, the Dear Jane. I mean, when a soldier is participating in the liberation of Paris and there's a young French woman who catches his eye. And are there, what sort of patterns did you notice or stories that stuck out to you on that side of things?
Well, on that side of things, you're absolutely right that, of course, those images that I'm sure we have all seen of GIs and French women kissing very amorously and enthusiastically in the liberation of Paris or elsewhere made it back into US newspapers. They were in places like Life magazine, which was hugely widely circulated at the time. And quite a lot of American women, whether they had a GI boyfriend or not, were not at all pleased to see that this was what liberation meant. They were quite unhappy that liberation seemed to have a sexual component to it, and that this was not only happening, but being thrust into their faces by the kindly photojournalists of Life magazine and others. And I definitely found in places like Stars and Stripes, the Army newspaper, or Yank, its weekly magazine, that Wax and other women were writing in and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, there are all you GIs loudly complaining about the fidelity of American women and Dear John letters. But look at your own record. I mean, there you are, you know, bringing your war brides home, because, of course, by 1944, 1945, this was another dominant story in World War II, British war brides and other Allied war brides. And not very long after the war, before German war brides were also sailing over. So there were definitely women who were keen to draw attention to these gendered and sexualized hypocrisies that were just rife. So men were definitely, men in uniform, especially, extended a pass when it came to fidelity and chastity. It was sort of tacitly expected and accepted that they might well find women overseas with whom to have sex and perhaps also enter into more committed, longer standing emotional relationships. And that was not at all true for women on the home front, who were just sort of relentlessly told that they had to remain faithful. They had to sort of wait with complete patience and monogamous fidelity to their man in uniform. So I think that's quite an interesting dimension of this story, that there have always been women in the 1940s and, of course, in later wars, just desperately trying to get the attention of journalists in the military, civilian journalists, to say, well, hang on a minute, while you're busily beating up on us for supposedly being so unfaithful, it's actually the case that far more men in uniform have been unfaithful to their American wives, girlfriends, fiancés, than the reverse. And of course, I mean, another sort of point that women sometimes made was that, and one reason I think perhaps why the Dear Jane trope was slower to catch on and never really took hold in the same way, is that it was also much more tacitly socially acceptable for a serviceman who had lost interest in a pre-existing romantic relationship, wanted to break it off, enter into some new relationship, simply to stop writing. So if it was bad for a woman to send a Dear John letter, it was even worse for her simply to disappear. Nowadays, we have a term, ghosting, for this practice, whereas men quite often would simply stop writing. And depending on your viewpoint, of course, that looks rather cowardly and cruel as well, to redeploy those adjectives typically applied to women. Because some women, if they knew that their partner was in a sort of frontline role, he was in danger, were bound to worry that his suddenly not writing letters anymore didn't mean that he had wanted out of the relationship or found a new girlfriend, but that he might actually be dead. So a lot of sort of complexity and difficulty around writing and silence. And of course, as we all know, there is nothing that's more readily susceptible to all manner of different interpretations than silence.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Absolutely. I'd like to return to a theme that we discussed earlier, where professional societies are debating the merits of rushing into marriage with men who are preparing to deploy overseas. Among a military and civil society that are, one could say, trying to weaponize romantic love in pursuit of martial ends. On the other hand, from World War II onward, I think the military, to its credit, really is concerned with the morale of its troops. You see the formation of the USO, United Service Organizations, where celebrities and actresses and others come to entertain the troops, and it's understood that I mean, you simply fight a war better if you keep troop morale up. And it's, I don't want to say it's completely for utilitarian ends. Maybe the military really did want their troops to be happy. What is the military and other members of civil society thinking about troop morale at this time as they see relationships break down during wartime?
So when you say this time, are we talking specifically here about World War II or?
World War II or any subsequent wars as well.
Well, I think you're right. Obviously, the military establishment has been very keen to figure out how to sustain morale and have done a lot of different things, including, as you say, the USO clubs, bringing over entertainers and so on. A lot of it, I think, very obviously directed towards service men, given that, you know, if we think perhaps in World War II, the USO clubs weren't in many cases even open to women in the Women's Army Corps, that there's an interesting gendered dimension to this, that it did often seem very expressly to be men's morale that needed to be boosted and women who were tasked with doing the boosting. And there's a great book by a historian and friend of mine called Cara Viewick, which I would recommend on this topic, called The Girls Next Door, which tells the story of USO entertainers from World War II right up to the present. So that's an interesting piece of the story. And obviously where romantic relationships fit in this has been a piece of the puzzle, the psychological puzzle of morale, what's constituent of it, how do you keep it elevated, that the military has really wrestled with. And I think has often been juggling very ambivalent views about marriage. Is it a good thing to have a married military labor force, or does marriage obstruct and perhaps distract service personnel from their primary attachment to the unit and to the chain of command? And these are really hard things to keep in lockstep. But definitely over the years, since 1973 and after Vietnam, as I'm sure your listeners know, this is the moment when the United States turns to becoming an all-volunteer force. And it's really in the aftermath of that huge shift in recruiting and in the population of the armed forces that the military becomes a much more avowedly family-friendly institution, especially from the 1980s onwards, doing far more to incentivize men and women who want to be married and have families and kids to find a place in the armed forces and making that possible or more desirable through the kinds of benefits and institutional structures that they offer. And in recent times, I'm guessing that probably many of your listeners will know that the Army and other branches of the armed forces have been wrestling with both high rates of marital breakdown and simultaneously with distressingly elevated rates of suicide amongst active duty personnel and veterans, and trying to sort of figure out that very complicated, knotty relationship between how do you make couples more resilient? By doing that, are you also perhaps likely to drive down rates of suicide, make the spouse who is in uniform, if both aren't more resilient and better able to sort of weather the pressures of deployment and serial deployment, or just how tough it can be to be in a military couple. So definitely over the last 15 years or so, all branches of the US Armed Forces have devoted a lot of energy, time, money into marital guidance programs, the Strong Bonds program in the Army, some of them delivered through the chaplaincy services and so on, trying to make the couple a more robust unit with a view to sort of improving the emotional, psychological well-being of partners and in turn, of course, the operational efficiency of their units. So it's a really intriguing, really complicated and sometimes quite challenging sort of story to piece together and to think through.
Well, I'm glad we could discuss this, because relationships in wartime are a complicated topic that are universal and in the background of any war that's fought. And it's hard not to fall into tropes from popular media, where Casablanca, that relationship is taking place on a stage in epic in a sweep and almost having a direct effect on the war, or other tropes that a man is fighting knowing that his best girl is home waiting for him to return. This continues all the way into the 21st century with Marvel movies, with Steve Rogers and Peggy Carter, and not to mention probably dozens of other films. So what are lessons and implications that you hope readers can take away from this story about relationships and their rockiness in wartime?
Well, what I hope readers would take away is perhaps a more nuanced appreciation of just how very, very hard it is to make love work in wartime, and that we need to be empathetic to both parties, male and female. Now, of course, the military is open to same-sex partnerships and marriages over the last decade, but it's not easy to make love work successfully when one or perhaps both partners are deployed. There's just so much pressure that being part of a military couple comes bundled up with. And of course, if you're deployed to a war zone, if you're in a sort of frontline role, then there are just tremendous psychological pressures on both parties, whether you're the one at home, but also, of course, particularly if you are undertaking a difficult and dangerous role, which sort of exposes you to all sorts of really sort of distressing human phenomena. And that's an extraordinary set of challenges for any couple to navigate their way through successfully. So I want my book to be one of sort of tolerance and empathy rather than the sort of knee-jerk reaction that any woman who ends a relationship must simply be damnably unfaithful, should be wiped from the face of the earth. I quote a particularly chilling line from General Patton, who sort of announced that any woman who sent a Dear John letter should be shot as a traitor. And of course, you know, Patton was given to these extreme sorts of speech acts, and it's not surprising that Patton would say something as intemperate and hostile as that. But that kind of view, even if it's expressed in slightly more moderate language, has reverberated on through the decades. And so I want to challenge that way of thinking.
Patton is very quotable for good or for ill, as we can see here. So
he definitely is, yes.
Well, I'm glad you could bring a lot of nuance to this because, as we discussed, I mean, this is a universal feature of human experience. And I think understanding it, and for this could very well be occupying the thoughts for both parties throughout much of the war. So getting into the psychology of that, I think really opens up a lot of doors of our understanding. And there's a lot more into this topic for listeners to delve into. And if they want to check out your book, the name of it is Dear John, Love and Loyalty in Wartime America. Susan, thank you for joining us.
Well, this has been great. So thank you, Scott. I've enjoyed talking.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.